Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We begin with the call for a tax on pandemic profiteers from the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres, who lamented the world's failure to unite around defeating the COVID pandemic, pointing out that inequality in vaccination around the world is just one example of this failure. Joining us is Dean Baker, senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, who writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where his latest article is Patents and the Pandemic, Can We Learn Anything? We will discuss how the $10 billion Operation Warp Speed, out of which the Pfizer, Moderna, and other vaccinations emerged, was socialism, with the costs and R&D socialized, but the profits privatized, since a dose costs between $2 and $5 to make, but the taxpayer pays Big Pharma $20 a dose, and Pfizer was able to charge a poor country like Uganda $37 a dose. Since the virus does not recognize national or international boundaries, and more deadly mutations are cropping up around the world, a global pooling of research and manufacturing would have saved countless lives. Then we'll examine the sanctions announced by the Biden administration today aimed at deterring, quote, Russia's harmful foreign activities, to punish Putin for the SolarWinds hack of U.S. government data and systems, with 32 entities and officials targeted for trying to influence the 2020 election and, quote, other acts of disinformation. James Goldgeier, senior visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor of international relations at American University, who served as director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasian affairs on the National Security Council, joins us to discuss his article at Foreign Affairs, U.S.-Russia Relations Will Only Get Worse. Even good diplomacy can't smooth a clash of interests. Then finally, we will look further into the likely fate of Afghanistan after the U.S. pulls out, and the hypocrisy of Biden's critics like Senator Lindsey Graham, who is happy to waste $2 trillion in a quagmire, but won't support spending $2 trillion on infrastructure at home. Thomas Barfield, a professor of anthropology at Boston University, who is the president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, joins us to discuss the possibility of unfortunate optics appearing on the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attack of a split screen of Americans observing solemn ceremonies while the Taliban triumphantly takes over large swaths of Afghanistan. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now, Dean Baker, who's a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where his latest article is Patents and the Pandemic, Can We Learn Anything? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Dean. And on Monday, the UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told a high-level UN meeting that there's obviously this global problem of inequality with COVID vaccinations, but that's just one example of the failure of multilateralism. And he went on to suggest that there should be a tax on pandemic profiteers. Quoting him, there has been a $5 trillion surge in the wealth of the world's richest in the past year. And he urged governments to consider a solidarity or wealth tax on those who have profited during the pandemic, to reduce extreme inequalities. Now, I don't know whether that's ever going to get off the ground, but there is clearly, at least the Secretary General of the United Nations is making connection between the inequality of vaccines and people getting vaccinated in advanced countries and not in poorer countries, and the fact that billionaires in this country in particular have gotten so much richer during this pandemic. So do you see the two as being connected?
Well, I don't see that much of a direct connection. I mean, the issues with patent monopolies, the factors that are preventing people in poorer countries from the vaccines, again, the vaccines have been longstanding and, you know, aren't really unique to the pandemic. In terms of billionaires getting richer, I mean, it's primarily a story of the stock market going up. Now, what really went on there was we made a decision to rescue companies, which arguably was the right decision. But the point was, this was very much a government intervention. So these people would like to be big fans of the market. Well, if you just left the market to itself, we would have had an economic collapse. I mean, I'm not saying it was would have been a good thing. But the point was that, yeah, because the government acted, you had some people that got made a lot of money in the pandemic, to put it as simply as possible. So I think some sort of excise tax. Now, I'm personally not a fan of wealth tax, particularly a one-time wealth tax, just because it'd be very, very hard to implement. But we have an income tax. We have both a corporate and individual income tax. So if you had a one-time, you know, 5 percentage point, 10 percentage point, I mean, you could decide how much it would be. But, you know, substantial supplement to that for corporations, high income individuals, that strikes me as a really good thing to do. And, you know, again, we know how to do that. So I don't see a lot of downsides.
Yeah, well, Dean, you mentioned government intervention. The fact that the government funneled $10 billion into Operation Warp Speed, they gave about $2 billion to Pfizer and another $1.5 billion to Moderna, and four other pharmaceutical companies also joined in Operation Warp Speed. Essentially, it was socialism that developed these vaccines, right?
Yeah, well, it was certainly government funding, and it goes way further back, too. So sometimes, because I've had arguments with people from the pharmaceutical industry, and they say, oh, well, they were working on these for years. There's some truth to that, but only a very limited amount, because in fact was the vast majority of the research, particularly to the mRNA vaccines, the ones produced by Pfizer and Moderna, that came directly from NIH, the National Institutes of Health. So that was public funding. So that doesn't mean Pfizer and Moderna put up zero, but the idea that they were working on these for years and years and put up billions, that's just nonsense. And for that matter, I just saw a paper, AstraZeneca, the vast majority of that research was actually AstraZeneca Oxford, the innovative research was done by Oxford, scientists at Oxford. That came from governments as well. So these are very much publicly funded vaccines. And then we turn around and we give them a patent monopoly and we say, oh, charge whatever you feel like. It's kind of incredible. So yeah, this is very much a handout to those companies that lacks, again, I understand incentives. I'm a fan of markets, but this makes zero sense.
So let's focus on Oxford. Oxford did the research, but in your article, you suggested that Bill Gates was the one who told them to hook up with a big pharmaceutical company like AstraZeneca, and not Oxford were prepared to give it away for free, weren't they?
Yeah, you know, so, you know, I can't comment on all the details, but I don't think the basic facts are disputed that the researchers at Oxford said, we're just going to make this available. We'll post all the information, help people produce it. And any company that has the manufacturing capacity anywhere in the world, they would be able to produce it. And Bill Gates insisted that, no, you have to line yourself up with a big pharmaceutical company. And AstraZeneca was the one that ended up getting it. I don't know the specifics as to how they were picked or, you know, what was involved. But in any case, AstraZeneca stepped up and they became the unique manufacturers. So this precluded widespread production of that vaccine. And again, we get into this kind of silly argument where they say, oh, well, it's not the patent rights. Well, a lot of it is the patent rights, but they say, oh, it takes a long time. These are complex manufacturing processes for both the mRNA vaccines and the AstraZeneca, which is a different method. But part of the story here is that they're complex. They are complex. Other people do have the ability to do it. Obviously, it'd be best if we had the engineers at AstraZeneca, at Pfizer, at Moderna. We had them sharing the technology. That would be the best outcome, and which we should require. But in any case, no one's going to go through the effort of designing a manufacturing capacity if they think that as soon as they have it up and running, you're going to have Moderna say, "Oh, well, now you have to pay us billions of dollars for infringing on our patent." So it's yeah, patents aren't the whole story, but they're a really big part of the story, and to pretend otherwise is just absurd.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, who's a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where his latest article is Patents and the Pandemic, Can We Learn Anything? So let's talk about your idea that we should be pooling everything, both the research and the expertise associated with manufacturing.
Well, this is something I argued really from the beginning of the pandemic. We have a worldwide problem and we have a common interest. And again, it's not just, I mean, I'm not going to say just, I mean, we should want to see people everywhere in the world protected from the coronavirus, but even just narrow self-interest. If a mutant develops in sub-Saharan Africa, in Pakistan, Bangladesh, it doesn't matter where, that's vaccine resistant, we're back at ground zero. And to my mind, you would have to be goddamn crazy to think that that's an acceptable outcome. And I don't know that will happen. It's a probabilistic question. The virus will mutate. That we know for certain. What's the probability there'll be a mutation that's going to end up being vaccine resistant, and then we're back at ground zero? I don't know. I don't think anyone can answer that question, but it's not insignificant. And given the incredible cost, the idea that we wouldn't want everyone in the world to be vaccinated as quickly as possible, that just seems crazy. Of course we should. And, you know, again, to my mind, the way to do that is you pull the technology. You want everyone to have as much information as possible about how to produce the vaccines, develop new techniques to produce the vaccines more quickly. Pfizer did that with its own engineers. Do we think their engineers are the only people in the world capable of increasing their productive efficiency? That would be kind of nuts to believe that. So that's what we should be doing. And I should also point out we should be doing it with Russia and China. They have vaccines. Let's get the data on how effective they are. They haven't been as transparent as we would want them to be, but hopefully we, you know, if there were an international agreement, we could get them to be transparent. And if those vaccines, where they're effective, if they could be produced in larger quantities, let's get them out. Let's get them distributed. And, you know, unfortunately, we're not doing that. We sure as hell didn't do it under Trump. We all could go America first. Hopefully Biden, well, we know he has a more serious approach, but he hasn't been willing to take that step.
Well, nobody did it worse than Trump. We are the worst off in the world, although India's rapidly catching up to us because of, I mean, it's an extraordinary disconnect that Trump was successful with Operation Warp Speed in getting vaccines, but he was hopeless at getting people vaccinated. And the mutations, it's always been a race between mutation and vaccination. So the longer it festers anywhere in the world, the virus clearly doesn't recognize national or international boundaries.
Yeah, I mean, of course, this started in Wuhan, China, at least as far as we know. Again, I understand there's disputes on that, but, you know, that's the best, I think, best most people agree to that. And it's gone all over the world. And the same thing will happen if we get a vaccine-resistant mutation in anywhere else in the world, because we're not going to be able to keep it localized. We're not going to be able to keep it in one small country in sub-Saharan Africa. It just doesn't work that way.
Well, today, the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, said that people will likely need a third dose of the COVID-19 vaccine within 12 months of getting fully vaccinated. So that's an indication that the mutations are happening and that they're going to have to tweak their formulas to catch up to the mutations, which seems to be working for Pfizer and for Moderna. But I don't know whether it's working quite so well for AstraZeneca and J&J. And J&J, of course, has a problem now with its vaccines being suspended. The disposition
that's
of
one of the things that people have said, and I think there's a lot of plausibility to it, that that's the big resistance of Pfizer and Moderna and the others for that matter, but those two obviously being the biggest with the mRNA vaccines, that they're envisioning that people might need boosters every, you know, 6 months or year for who knows how long. So whatever they make in the pandemic itself, if let's envision that we bring it under control 2021, 2020, somewhere in the not too distant future, let's just say, that in years later, they'll still be making money from selling their vaccine and perhaps at a much higher price. I mean, already it's way, way above what it cost them. It cost them $2, $3, $4. We don't know the exact figures, but somewhere in their neighborhood, and they're selling it for around 20. Well, maybe a year out, they're going to be selling it for 50. And if people could pay it or get their insurer to pay it or the government, they'll do that. So they're, you know, the argument is that Pfizer and Moderna aren't just looking at, oh, we might lose some business in 2021 or 2022. They're thinking years out, and that would be really big bucks for them. And again, I should point out, because again, I've debated people from the industry, they go, what would be their incentive? They already made back their investment many, many times over. So the idea that if they can't have some incredible bonanza, then they've lost all incentive, that's just kind of crazy. That's not the way the market typically works.
But let's zero in then, Dean Baker, on the cost of a Pfizer or a Moderna shot. You say that what, it costs about $2?
Well, we don't know their exact production cost. Figure a range of 2 to 5. I mean, there have been different estimates. They don't share the information. But if it's below 2, it's not much below 2. If it's above 5, it's surely not much above 5. So it's somewhere in that range. My guess is probably closer to 2 than 5. But in any case, that's the range we're talking about. And they're charging 18 to 20. There have been some reports, because again, they don't disclose their contracts, but there have been some reports. I think it was Pfizer was selling vaccines to, I could have the country wrong, I believe it was Uganda for $37. You know, Uganda, of course, being a very poor country. So you'd like to see them paying less, not more. But again, they're very secretive about what these contracts are. So I'll be the first to say I would not swear by that figure. But there are reports they're charging considerably higher to some countries.
But in the United States, they're charging the U.S. government, aren't they? I mean,
yeah. So the U.S. government, I'm forgetting, I think our contract, or at least our initial contract, because we're getting more doses, but was $20 a shot. So again, I can't say for sure whether subsequent contracts were the same amount, were they less, were they more, I don't know. That might be publicly available, that I don't know, but the original one was $20 a shot.
Well, if it's only costing a maximum $5 a shot and they're getting $20, that's a pretty hefty profit, isn't it?
Oh, sure. So, you know, say they're doing 200 million vaccines somewhere in the ballpark of what they're actually doing, and they're making $15 a vaccine. That's $3 billion. And again, their research cost, I'm sure they weren't a fifth that, a sixth that. And again, getting back to what the industry will typically tell you, because obviously I've been involved in talking about pharmaceuticals for a long time, they'll say, oh, it takes us years and years to work on a drug, and oftentimes they end up being failures. So when they actually come through, we have to make a lot of money on those to make up for all the failures. Well, in this case, there was relatively little risk of failure. So much of the research was paid for by the governments anyhow, and they had guaranteed purchase agreements. So suppose the Pfizer vaccine turned out not to be very effective. It met the minimal standards. The FDA approved it. But it just wasn't a very good vaccine. The AstraZeneca vaccine was better. The Moderna vaccine. We were obligated to buy 100 million doses from them at $20 a dose. So they took very little risk. It wasn't a long time, very little risk. And they're walking away with an awful lot of money and profit.
Well, when Pfizer first proclaimed that its trial results were successful, when they were announced, the CEO of Pfizer, Albert Bourla, said, "I believe this is likely the most significant medical advance in the last 100 years, if you count the impact this will have on public health and the global economy." And that same day, Bourla cashed in $5.6 million of Pfizer stocks. And of course, his pay is $21 million a year for 2020. So he's doing well as well. So is this because the Trump administration made this deal? I mean, you know, if the taxpayer subsidized the R&D and Operation Warp Speed paid for the whole damn thing, I just don't see why these people should be profiting, and particularly why they should be charging the government of a poor country like Uganda almost twice what they're charging the American taxpayer.
Yeah, the story on the funding for the research, the Times had a very good piece on one of the key researchers for it, this woman who was, came to the U.S. from Hungary and worked on contracts. She was an assistant in labs where someone else had gotten the university labs where someone else had gotten a government contract. And according to the Times, she never made more than $60,000 a year. So this is someone who is one of the leaders in developing the mRNA technology, which is revolutionary. I mean, I'm not a biochemist, so I can't say I fully understand it, but I know people who do, and they think it's a great technology. It's going to have huge implications for health years to come. The CEO of Pfizer wasn't wrong. Now, what is wrong or misleading is that Pfizer was the major contributor to it, because it certainly was not. But they certainly were the major beneficiary. And in terms of the contract that was signed, obviously the Trump administration couldn't care less. Now, again, would Biden have signed a totally different one? I'd like to think he'd have signed one that did provide for more sharing of the technology with other countries, and particularly in the developing world, limiting prices. I can't say, but clearly these were things Trump didn't care about. So he just said, okay, Pfizer, give us 100 million vaccines at $20 each, and we're good. You could do whatever you want, charge what other countries whatever you want. That was not in the contract.
Well, of course, they've been getting a lot of good PR, right, these big companies, because people are so anxious about the vaccination. So this side of the story is not really being told, is it?
Not very much. I mean, you do see there was a fantastic piece on Bill Gates's role in this that appeared in the New Republic just earlier this week, because Bill Gates, you know, as I mentioned, was instrumental in getting AstraZeneca to take control of the Oxford vaccine. But Bill Gates has been, his foundation has been instrumental in preserving patent protections in prescription drugs for decades. So that's gotten some play. But yeah, I mean, people naturally, rightfully, will say, hey, this vaccine's great. I was worried about getting a deadly disease, and now pretty much protected against it. It allows us to go out and see our friends. I mean, that's a great thing. But the point is, the role of the companies, the Moderna and Pfizer, AstraZeneca, I'm not going to say it was irrelevant, but they aren't the heroes of the story. They piggybacked on the it's sort of like the pitcher World Series, you know. You have a pitcher pitches eight innings of shutout pitching, and then you have the reliever come in the ninth inning and comes in for the save. Well, that's great, but you had a pitcher that was there for eight innings and pitched shutout. Well, that's the one who really did the hard work. And this is kind of the story here with mRNA technology, that you had a lot of people, many of them, I don't know, many of them worked for less than $60,000 a year, but some of them did. They aren't making out like bandits, but Moderna, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, they are.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
And again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's a senior economist and co-founder of the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He's the author of The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, and Rigged, How Globalization and the Rules of the Modern Economy Were Structured to Make the Rich Richer. And he writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, where his latest article is Patents and the Pandemic, Can We Learn Anything? We're going to take a brief station break and back examining the sanctions announced today by the Biden administration at deterring, quote, Russia's harmful foreign activities.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is James Goldgeier, who is a senior visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of international relations at American University, who has held a number of public policy appointments, including director of Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian affairs on the National Security Council staff. His books include Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Towards Russia After the Cold War, and Not Whether, But When, the U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO. And he's the author of an article at Foreign Affairs, U.S.-Russian Relations Will Only Get Worse. Even Good Diplomacy Can't Smooth a Clash of Interests. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Goldgeier.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And your article begins with the line, "It is hard to imagine that U.S.-Russian relations could get much worse, but sadly, they're unlikely to get better anytime soon." Well, after the sanctions imposed today, I would imagine they are going to get worse. But how much do you think they were tempered in any way by the phone conversation that President Biden had with Vladimir Putin on Tuesday?
Well, I think the phone call was an opportunity for both presidents to explain their views to the other, and that often is at least helpful for underlining how they see their interests. And it was clear from the readout that President Biden wants to focus on strategic stability talks, arms control. The nuclear area is the one area that is most conducive to cooperation between these two countries, and if there is going to be any cooperation between them in the bilateral relationship, that's the place to start. So that was good to see. And of course, President Biden also expressed unwavering support for Ukraine's sovereignty and territorial integrity, which Vladimir Putin is violating. So there is a clash of interest and views there. And President Biden also offered to meet with President Putin sometime in the coming months in a third country. So it will be interesting to see what comes from that.
But I understand that Russia is on high nuclear alert. And I don't understand why we are not pushing back against that. You know, if somebody puts a gun in your face, it's you know, obviously, if they don't pull the trigger, it's better than being shot. But on the other hand, it's still no less frightening. And that's what I wonder about. This seems like nuclear delinquency. Why would Russia have its nuclear forces on high alert while it's massing 80,000 troops on Ukraine's border?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we don't know what Putin's motivations are right now. You know, there's some people who believe that he was angry that President Biden answered the question about whether or not Putin's a killer by saying yes. So I think it's a bit of a stretch to say all this is just because he was angry at being called a killer. But I think, you know, it's the first few months of an administration, and it's an administration that doesn't have a full team in place yet on European and Russian affairs. And it may simply be that Putin is trying to test the new administration. The troops on the border is of great concern because it could easily lead to some kind of miscalculation. And it's also potentially a case of Putin trying to provoke the Ukrainians into doing something that would give Putin a pretext for sending those troops into Ukraine. So the situation is very dangerous. And, you know, we've now also seen, unrelated to that, the administration has announced new sanctions on Russia because of the SolarWinds hack last year and the Russian election interference. So there's definitely a lot going on.
Well, in terms of those sanctions, and there were 32 entities targeted by these sanctions, prior sanctions have had the effect, to some extent, of backfiring because Putin's able to tell the Russian people that the reason that things aren't going well are not because me and my cronies are stealing you blind, but because the Americans are sanctioning you. So how targeted are they? In other words, if you go after the Siloviki and the oligarchs that Putin regulates, That would make some sense, wouldn't it?
Yes, I mean, you know, the challenge on the sanctions is sort of what are you trying to accomplish with the sanctions? You know, it's an easy tool for us to reach for because, you know, it doesn't involve using military force. So something happens and you want to do something and you think, oh, well, we'll put sanctions on. And the question is, what's the purpose? There are sort of two major ones. One is that you're actually trying to get a change in behavior. And that requires that you're imposing enough costs that the party you're targeting thinks it's better to change that behavior. That's something that's been very hard to do with respect to Putin, partly because you have to be able to convince the other side that if they change their behavior, you would take the sanctions off. I don't think he believes those sanctions are coming off. So I think it's a hard tool to use for that reason. The other is because you just want to hold somebody accountable for something they've done. And I think that's a lot of this with respect to the fact that Putin engaged in the election interference, that he did the SolarWinds hack. I think, you know, the Biden administration presumably feels like they can't just let that go. I think we'll see something similar if Alexei Navalny, the main opposition leader who was imprisoned by Putin, if he dies in prison. I think we will see calls for additional sanctions again to hold people accountable, even if that doesn't actually change any behavior.
Well, recently, in fact, on Sunday, I interviewed Dr. Pavel Felgenhauer, an independent military analyst who writes for Novaya Gazeta, which is the only independent newspaper left in Russia. And he gave a very dire scenario, basically that Putin is surrounding Ukraine. A lot of military forces are being moved from Siberia and the Urals into the northeast border. The ground is still muddy, so they wouldn't launch an armored attack for maybe a month or so. But they're also massing landing craft and marines on the Black Sea coast. And the scenario would be that it basically is just a knockout blow to encircle the Ukrainian military and top of the government. And you know, they're obviously pro-Russian actors there that they could install, including the guy that they'd just been sanctioning, Putin's buddy. And the idea would be then that what would be left would be a rump landlocked state in the West that would become a ward of Western governments. So I know it's pretty dire, but is there any chance of that? In other words, is Putin motivated by the fact that Ukraine wants to join NATO and wants to integrate with the EU? So if that's inevitable, why not nip it in the bud if you can?
Well, he definitely, you know, has made clear that he doesn't want to see Ukraine join NATO or move closer to the EU. There's no question that he sees that as a red line. Part of it is just the way he views Ukraine. You know, he's many years ago when George W. Bush was president and they were talking about Ukraine, he supposedly said to President Bush, George, you know, Ukraine isn't a real country. He doesn't see it as independent. He sees it as belonging to Russia. He thinks the West should stay out of Ukraine's business and Russia's business. And, you know, he won't even talk to President Zelensky of Ukraine because he doesn't view him as a real president of a real country. So the situation is very dangerous. Having someone like Pavel Felgenhauer talk about how dangerous it is of great concern. I think Putin is clearly doing something where he can leave his options open. Bringing troops from other parts of the country to mass on the border is very concerning. And, you know, as I said, I mean, part of it may simply be he wants to do something and he's trying to provoke the Ukrainians into doing something first, the way he did in Georgia in 2008. That would give him a pretext. So I'm sure, you know, Secretary of State Blinken met with the Ukrainian foreign minister recently. And so, you know, I'm sure the conversation between the U.S. and Ukraine is about how to make sure Ukraine does not do anything that would provoke a renewed Russian invasion.
Yeah. So what happened in 2008, of course, in Georgia was a sucker punch. So I guess they're trying to avoid that. They're obviously in a weak position anyways, Ukraine, and it doesn't cost Putin that much to destabilize them as he does through these proxies in the Donbass. But isn't at the heart of this problem, and it's what you talk about in your article at Foreign Affairs, James Golguy, U.S.-Russian relations will only get worse. Even good diplomacy can't smooth a clash of interests. The clash of interests are pretty fundamental, isn't it? Putin and Xi Jinping don't believe in democracy, and they're actually aggressively trying to show that democracy doesn't work and that their autocracies do work. So they're deeply invested in sabotaging or undermining democracy, and Putin has been actively trying to undermine U.S. democracy, and that's what these sanctions are in response to. And what he offers to Ukraine is the Belarus model. In other words, we're happy to have gangster government, but we don't want democracy. And my understanding is that what's happened in Ukraine is that the Ukrainian people have turned against Putin, not so much against the Russian people, but against Putin, because they were always had very close fraternal ties with Russia. And those ties have been torn up. And so if he were to invade, wouldn't he be subject to guerrilla war and at least something along the lines of what happened to the Soviet troops when they went into Prague in 1968?
Well, I mean, he's definitely stimulated Ukrainian nationalism. I think, you know, the Ukrainian sense of identity has been stimulated by Putin's aggression since 2014. And I think the desire to draw closer to the West has been stimulated by Putin's aggression. As you say, Ukraine really was seeking to try to balance its relationship between Russia and Europe and the West. And it is the case that Putin tries to destabilize these countries. He doesn't want democracy in these countries. And I think it goes even beyond not wanting them to succeed as democracies. He's afraid of democracy. And he's afraid that if these countries are successful, that somehow will affect his own ability to stay in power in Russia. And he doesn't want democracy anywhere on the borders, and he certainly doesn't want it in Russia. And he has gone to great lengths to destabilize those countries surrounding neighboring Russia. And he's gone to great lengths to try to undermine democracy in the West. So, there is this fundamental difference between how we approach foreign policy and his views on what he thinks are Russia's interests, or at least his own interests.
So where then is the path forward? We mentioned earlier the Tuesday phone conversation between Biden and Putin. Now, I understand that perhaps this is some kind of concession, that the two Navy destroyers that were going to enter the Black Sea, I think they've turned around. Is that what you've heard?
That's what the latest reports were, that they, in fact, have turned around.
Right. So, and the invitation to meet in a third country, we don't know whether Putin's going to take him up on that. And as you mentioned earlier, if Navalny dies in prison, which seems like Putin's killing him slowly after trying to kill him with Novichok, now he's, you know, taking a second bite of the apple, that's likely to cause a backlash. So what are the chances of a summit?
Well, I think Putin will accept. Russian leaders like to have summits. That's why, you know, it was a big deal for President Biden to offer it. Putin has spent his two decades as president rebuilding Russia's status as a great power. He wants Russia to be seen as an equal to the United States. That's why nuclear arms control is the best area for cooperation, because it's the one area where the two countries are the two superpowers. And so I think he'll be happy to have a meeting, certainly happy to agree to it, in part because he may feel like the United States will hold back in its responses to what he does, in the hopes of having a good meeting whenever that takes place. So I would be very surprised if he turned down that invitation.
But in the meantime, if Felgenhauer is correct that they're waiting for the ground to dry for a massive armored assault through the north from the northeast, coordinated with a landing along the Black Sea and Odessa and other cities to create a landlocked rump state you know, basically anything west of the Dnieper would be the rump state, and everything on the east would be what, New Russia is what they call it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, like I said, I mean, it's certainly possible that this could happen, and he's setting up the situation that he could do this, and we should be very concerned about it. I think he's probably simply keeping his options open at this point and seeing how things develop. But it is very worrying, and it is hard for the United States to respond. The United States is not going to go to war with Russia over Ukraine. I think, you know, right now the main goal from the U.S. side is coordinating with NATO allies so that everybody's on the same page in terms of how to talk about this, how to respond to this, and not let this issue divide the West. I think that would be one of Putin's goals. And I think the United States is going to be very keen not to let that happen.
Well, James Golga, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with James Golgi, who is a senior visiting fellow at the Brookings Institution and a professor of international relations at American University. And he held a number of public policy appointments, including director of Russian, Ukrainian, and Eurasian affairs on the National Security Council staff. And his books include Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Towards Russia After the Cold War, and Not Whether But When, the U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO. And he's the author of an article at Foreign Affairs, U.S.-Russian Relations Will Only Get Worse, Even Good Diplomacy Can't Smooth a Clash of Interests. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the hypocrisy of Biden's critics, like Senator Lindsey Graham, who's happy to waste $2 trillion in a quagmire in Afghanistan, but won't spend $2 trillion on infrastructure at home. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies, and he's the co-author of Afghanistan, an Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Barfield.
Thank you very much.
So, following President Biden's announcement yesterday that the United States will start pulling out its 2,500 plus troops in Afghanistan beginning on May the 1st and ending on September the 11th, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, could we have at the end of the day on September the 11th of this year the kind of split screen image of Americans observing the 20th anniversary of the attack on the World Trade Center, the Pentagon, and the attempted attack on the Capitol, split screen with the Taliban taking over Afghanistan?
It potentially could happen. I think, given the political dynamics in Afghanistan, that is relatively unlikely. These kind of things in Afghanistan tend to take longer to work themselves out. But I actually believe that President Biden, by picking a symbolic date of September the 11th, has made himself a hostage to fate, that even if Kabul is not falling, you could easily have a split screen where they would attempt to do something rather spectacular just to show that they could. I think it's probably a mistake to not only pick a specific date without asking for anything in return, but to pick a symbolic one like that, because it gives your enemy a chance to embarrass you on that date. Politically, I don't think it was well thought through.
But what I find extraordinary, though, Tom, is that you've got people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell criticizing Biden, and Lindsey Graham is all in a lather over it. And yet these guys are perfectly happy to spend $2 trillion on a wasted effort. At the same time, they're fighting $2 trillion to invest in American infrastructure. I mean, I don't get that picture. Why fill potholes in Kabul and not fill potholes in Main Street, USA?
Well, it would be nice, actually, if they did fill potholes in Kabul. There are many, and they haven't been filled for years. But I think what we're looking at is political theater, that Afghanistan is rarely on the American radar screen politically unless it's in somebody's interest. And these are the same people that seem to have no trouble with Trump pulling out on May 1st that suddenly find the same policy on September 11th to be unconscionable. So I find it ironic that some of the arguments that they make are actually effective arguments, but they're made in such an insincere way that it makes it hard to have a rational debate about what should we do in Afghanistan. And certainly the question of continuing on as we're doing, I think, has been a mistake. That's what we've been doing for kicking the can for 20 years. But to announce something without thinking through and what happens the day after is typical of American administration short-sightedness when it comes to Afghanistan.
So it seems, though, and I interviewed yesterday a specialist on Afghanistan, Chris Fair, and she was basically saying the American project in Afghanistan has been doomed from day one because for some reason or other, we never dealt with the fact that the Pakistanis were stabbing us in the back at every turn. So do you have an answer to that puzzling question, Tom? Why is it that we never really took on, even though the military knew this was happening? Bin Laden was found within a mile of Pakistan's West Point. We know that they've been going across the border. We know that all the ANFO, ammonium nitrate, that was used for these IEDs that blew the limbs off American soldiers, all came from Pakistan. And in fact, it's even worse than that. I learned from the interview yesterday with Chris Fair that the company that produced the ammonium nitrate, which is ostensibly a fertilizer, refused to sell the non-lethal version of ammonium nitrate to Afghanistan. But in Pakistan itself, they sold the non-lethal version to Pakistani farmers. So it's never made any sense. Why have we never held Pakistan to account for their perfidy?
Not a military question, but a political one. And it's been a very good one. Even today, we talk about Afghanistan as a civil war in Afghanistan or the Taliban or the insurgency. But in fact, the Taliban are a Pakistani proxy. If we want peace in Afghanistan, essentially we have to deal with their patrons. There's probably no problem in Afghanistan that the Afghans cannot reconcile among themselves eventually. But we're not dealing with a purely internal insurgency. We're dealing with a policy that's gone on, sponsored by Pakistan, really since the late 1970s. But there's been an absolute unwillingness to deal with this, and it continues onward here that we don't see any sign that the Biden administration is thinking beyond Afghanistan. And if we want stability in Afghanistan, that's what we do have to think about.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also the president of the American Institute for Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. So the French government, by the way, are ordering their nationals out of Pakistan because of the blasphemy laws, which are making anybody that's not a Muslim, you know, life in danger. What kind of victory is the ISI, the Pakistan Intelligence Service? What do they have here in assuming that at the end of the day, the Taliban take over? I mean, we know that the leader of Pakistan is the cricket player is basically a tool of the military. So what are these generals going to end up with? I mean, what do they want out of this thing?
I mean, is this going to be a kind of bitter fruit?
I believe it will be. I believe the term Pyrrhic victory for winning something at a unsustainable loss will follow this. Essentially, they're trying to replicate what they did before. They helped sponsor the Taliban into power in the mid-1990s, and they assumed essentially that Afghanistan would be their fifth province. They could tell the Afghans what to do. But after 9/11, when the Americans demanded the Taliban turn over Osama bin Laden, Mullah Omar refused. Even when Pakistan said, do this, otherwise the Americans will be coming. They discovered that their Afghan proxies were not the pawns that they thought they were. I think Pakistan will discover that if the Taliban too take over, and I'm not sure that that is a foregone conclusion given Afghanistan's history, but if they do, they're quite likely to find that just as they got a Pakistani Taliban, that attention may be turned the opposite direction to taking out the Pakistani government. They've been dealing with insurgents. They may have opened the Pandora's box to discover that that the country that has the most to lose from the instability in its long border with Afghanistan is Pakistan. And that's the country that's most destabilizing Afghanistan right now.
So is there any way for a wake-up call here? Can the neighborhood get its act together and do anything about this, fill this vacuum that the U.S. is creating? And presumably ISAF as well is leaving along with the U.S., the NATO allies.
Yes. One of the things that you do have to realize is when the Soviets pulled out of Afghanistan, they also presumed that the regime they left behind would fall within 6 months. And it actually survived the Soviet Union. It only collapsed after the Soviet Union was gone. Because if the United States is true to its commitment of leaving behind money and weapons, it turns out it's one thing for insurgents to get foreigners to leave Afghanistan. They want to leave. But it's quite another thing for an unconventional guerrilla force to then gear up to fight a conventional war that they would need to take out the cities. They currently don't have that capacity. So it's likely to be stalemate unless the Kabul regime simply collapses. Most regimes change in Afghanistan not because one side wins a battle, but because the other side dissolves and the other side picks up the pieces. But turning to Pakistan, this is now a problem for China, which is paranoid in Xinjiang about potential Muslim insurgents. And yet its major ally in the region is Pakistan. As long as the United States has been maintaining stability in Afghanistan, China, Russia, they didn't need to realize anything, fix anything about this. Now that the Americans look like they are on their way out, I could see China putting considerable pressure on Afghanistan and Pakistan to settle their differences, because that's in China's best interest. And if Pakistan isn't listening to us, they may be more likely to be listening to what they call their all-weather ally, which is China. So we'll have to see. But the Americans have been maintaining stability in the region, such as it is. And the fear of anarchy is less going to impact the United States and North America as it is going to be the region. And so those regional powers have a lot to lose if Afghanistan falls into further anarchy.
Well, it certainly doesn't make a lot of sense that the U.S. military are protecting Chinese mines in Afghanistan. I mean, here we are, $2 trillion, and what have we bought? One of the things that Chris Fair was talking about yesterday was that this notion that there's only corruption in Afghanistan and there's no corruption in the United States, in the sense she was making the argument that 90% of the aid that's gone to Afghanistan ends up back here in the United States through contractors, and that what the U.S. has invested in and built there has been cheap second-rate stuff, because these contractors taking as much money for themselves and pocketing that and building shoddy stuff like the ring road around Kabul and these schools that are badly built and curriculums that don't really make a lot of sense. I mean, is that true?
Yes, that is true. When people say $2 trillion spent, well, if you look at it, most of that was military, which was essentially that's the cost of our troops. That's money not spent in Afghanistan. That's money spent on Americans or in America. But again, a lot of these contracts and things were the money was allocated, the money was spent, but most of it was not spent in Afghanistan. And most of the stuff that was built there, as Chris Fair was saying, was pretty shoddy. The ring road, which is in bad shape, is the equivalent of a two-lane country highway in the United States. With this kind of money, we should have built an autobahn or interstate. We didn't. We allowed contractors, we allowed others to take advantage of a honeypot in Afghanistan. There were a lot of Afghans that dipped their hands into that as well. But if we want to look at the waste of money, we have to put a lot of the blame on ourselves, is that the Afghans must have been thinking, well, if the Americans certainly don't care about how the money is being spent, why should we? But the unfortunate thing is, when we look at the amounts of money, Afghanistan should resemble Dubai these days, given the amount of money that was put in. But it was misspent. It wasn't spent in Afghanistan. And one of the reasons the Taliban are succeeding is we didn't really improve the standard of living for most Afghans.
So the big question that's being asked is the fate of the women and girls. Since you've spent a lot of time in the country over the long period of time, Tom, what's your feeling just here in the last few minutes of the fate of women and girls in that country? Because lately, since these deals were worked out in Doha, the Taliban have not been killing American soldiers, but they sure as hell have been killing Afghan civilians, mostly women and journalists.
The position of women is going to be particularly difficult because the Taliban have a very bad track record in this area. But one of the things we have to look at is that in the areas that they currently rule now, which is in the countryside, women's lives had not much changed before or after the American intervention. But Kabul, which had maybe a half million people in it in 2001, is now a vibrant city of between 4 and 5 million people that has a large population of educated women that hold jobs and other things. The Taliban are going to find it very difficult, if they even attempt it, to try to implement the policies that they did in 2001. And they'll also find themselves in a dilemma. If the Taliban do take power, their government cannot survive without international aid. To the extent that they implement some of the policies they did in 2001 against the women of Afghanistan, or begin to oppress the minorities in Afghanistan, they will not be able to raise any international funds to support their own government. They'll find themselves on the verge of collapse. But I think the basic problem that they will discover is the majority of Afghans' population has now been born since 2001. For most Afghans in Afghanistan today, they know of the Taliban only because their fathers and grandfathers told them about them, or they maybe saw them when they were little kids. And the Afghanistan that they're coming back to in the cities, not in the countryside, but in the cities, is an entirely different world than the one they left in 2001. And I think they may find their struggle to turn back the clock to be far more difficult than they anticipate, whether they're foreigners there or not.
Well, Thomas Barfield, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Barfield, who's a professor of anthropology at Boston University, where he directs the Institute for the Study of Muslim Societies and Civilizations. He's also president of the American Institute of Afghanistan Studies and the co-author of Afghanistan, An Atlas of Indigenous Domestic Architecture. And his latest book is Afghanistan, A Cultural and Political History. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
The headline written down.